This is our last session for the week on Memories of God. And for those of you who have been here before, you recall that what we have been working on is trying to find the intersections between Christian doctrine and our own experience in order to claim the doctrine and bring the experience together in such a way that it makes sense for us so that we are liberated and grow in the love of God and neighbor through our faith rather than being held down and oppressed by that or hurt or just simply having it irrelevant to us. And I have been using material from this book of mine, Memories of God, all week, and telling you stories from that book and from my life, and reflecting on those theologically, as I keep saying, not because I'm just such a fascinating person, but because I'm a pretty typical person in a lot of ways. And what I want to do is more to give a method, a way of doing that, and help you find a way to do that for yourself and claim what you're probably perhaps already doing. And there are lots of reasons that I think this is important to try to work in like this. For one thing, in our churches and Christianity in the 20th century, really for a very long time from the 18th century on, we've made such a split between private religious experience and private religion and public religion that we have lost our ability to talk sometimes about those two things at the same time. And the only way that we're going to learn how to do that is by doing it. Now, I grew up in a household where, you know, if you had to talk about sex, if you just had to, you know, you could go off with Mama privately, you know, and shut the door to the bedroom or the bathroom and ask a question. But there were no circumstances when it was all right to talk about religion. It was just too unspeakably rude. You know, it was just, you know, it was on the same order as belching at the table, only much, much, much worse. You know, and, you know, and we tend to, in our churches, to perpetuate that kind of stuff. And in my education in the 50s and 60s, and that would be the education of a lot of people here, I did not have a unique education at all, we were taught to keep separate our private feelings and commitments and convictions and certainly our experience from the great questions of Christian thought and Christian doctrine. One of the things I remember having a conversation with a friend in the 60s whose husband taught philosophy, so this wasn't just religion. And he was spouting off about something philosophical and citing Hegel or something, somebody like that. And I said, well, this just doesn't, you know, that sounds great, but it just doesn't fit with my experience at all. You know, this just doesn't make sense to me experientially. And Mary, who was greatly into this way of looking at things, just immediately said, that's the trouble with women. They always confuse things by bringing in their experience. You know? Now, as I said, this was not an unusual sort of conversation to have. What might be unusual was that it was a woman who was making that comment, but the philosophy that went behind it was not uncommon then. And we have, especially in liberal Protestantism, have lost our ability to kind of make those connections an awful lot of times. So what I'm trying to do is find a way to do theology in such a way that we can both claim what the broad doctrines of Christianity and still say how they mean something to us personally. And why it matters that we believe these things. What difference does it make? You know, it's not just enough to say, well, I affirm the resurrection. What is the resurrection about? You know, who cares? Is all we have to do say, well, I believe this implausible event and that makes me a Christian. You know, it's not believing that it happened that is the significance of it. And that gets me to our topic for this evening, which is the resurrection. Now, when I was a child and an adult in most of my adult life, I always knew that the crucifixion was important. You're going to be a Christian. Crucifixion is important. Now, there have been times in my life when I wasn't sure what it was important for, what it was about, what it meant, but I always knew that it had relevance to me, that I'd better figure it out because it made a big difference. But almost at any point in my life, up to a few years ago, if you'd asked me what the resurrection was about, I wouldn't have been able to give you any answer. You know, it was about, well, Jesus rose from the dead. You know, it was something about Jesus. It wasn't something about me. It was something about Jesus. Now, that's kind of my introductory statement about where I started with all this before we get to the issue of what is the resurrection about. Well, let me start and make some comments again about my childhood. I keep telling you, you all will know so much about my childhood by the end of this week. But what I hope is that you will have thought about your own childhood in analogous ways. When I was a tiny child, before I started school, I lived with my mother and my father and my grandmother, who was my father's mother. And I adored my grandmother, and my grandmother adored me. Everything I did, she thought was wonderful. And she was convinced that I was the smartest, greatest, best baby in the whole world. She tended to phrase this in the following manner: "Oh, isn't she smart? She's just like her father." Which did not ever endear my mother to me. And the fact is that one of the things that I learned very early on is that I was a child from very young who it was really important to me that I please people and that I be regarded as good. You know, I like to hear, "Oh, what a good child." What I learned fairly early on was that I wasn't likely to hear that from my grandmother and my mother simultaneously. That what would please my mother would not please my grandmother, and what would please my grandmother would anger my mother. And all this I remember is a sort of symbolic thing when my grandmother took me out and cut my hair while my mother was gone one day. And I was very happy with this. And I thought, "Oh, what a good child. Aren't I beautiful?" And then my mother came home and cried, and I was punished. And, you know, and then my father was the third person in the mix in those early preschool years. What all three of these important people had in common, though, besides the fact that what pleased one could not please another, is that they all had very high expectations for me. And they were conflicting expectations, and sometimes they were conflicting in the same person. Both of my mother and my father seemed to... Well, I remember when I started school that my father would make statements like, with respect to school teachers, those who can do, those who can't teach. And then he would turn around and three sentences later he would say to me, "Now you should respect your teacher." So it seems like from the beginning, as early as I can remember, that what I got from both parents and my grandmother was were mixed messages where of things that I was expected to do and be. Now this happens to every child again. You know, it's not that I was an unusual child in that respect. Maybe the people in my life, the grown-ups, were a bit more powerful than a lot of grown-ups in a lot of people's lives. They were. None of these people were people to mess with. But what I learned very early on was the most important thing in the world was to be good and to be approved. And at the same time, that whatever I did, I couldn't do it. By the time I got pretty early on in school, actually I remember this going from the time I started kindergarten, but I was pretty depressed by the time I was five, say. And I was depressed and just consumed by anxiety all the way through school. Now, we have a paragraph or two to read you here about this. And the result of my depression was that I did really badly in school. I mean, I was so focused on, was I going to be able to do the work and please the teacher and so forth, that I was so consumed by anxiety about this that I couldn't even think about the work. All I could think about was what was going to happen. My parents dealt with this, and the school dealt with it by sending letters home to my parents saying that I was an underachiever. And my father dealt with this like he dealt with all problems in his children, which was to punish and spank and withhold desserts and, you know, all that good stuff. And he would make these speeches, you know, that would go, "Your teacher says you're an underachiever," in a voice he would proclaim that would have frightened an entire gang of juvenile delinquents. "We'll see about that. There won't be any desserts for you till you straighten up. No more privileges without responsibility." That was one of his favorite things. "Now straighten up and quit crying, or I'll give you something to cry about." That I heard many times through my childhood. "Well, straighten up. I could no more have straightened up by myself than the bent over woman whom Jesus healed in Luke 13. I know very well that the grown-ups' accusations of laziness, carelessness, disobedience, and unhappiness were true. I was convinced they were true. I loved my parents, and I was humiliated and deeply shamed by who I was for them. I looked in the mirror at my plain brown pigtails, my glasses, and my skinny body, and I hated myself. If I made them angry, then I embraced with a vengeance the task of doing their job for them when they weren't around. Daily, I recounted my failures to myself with the faithful and imaginative regularity of a praying saint. Making myself feel terrible was the one responsibility I could always fulfill." Now, the conservative Christianity of my childhood offered me no way out of my unhappiness. Rather, with its emphasis on sin and on the thorough badness of all people and Jesus' death for it, it actually gave me an explanation for why I ought to be depressed, as I understood it. Sin was what religion was about. If you'd asked me in the fourth grade, "Why was Jesus born?" I would have been glad to say it was because of sin. Jesus was born in order to pay the price of our sin by suffering and dying on the cross. And then if you'd pushed me about what it took to get our sins forgiven, I would have told you, we have to repent of our sins. And if you had pushed me a little further to ask, what does it mean to repent? I would have said, to feel really, really, really bad about what a sinful person you are. And if you nudged a little more one more time and asked, what does Jesus' resurrection have to do with any of this? I would have looked at you blankly. The resurrection doesn't have anything to do with sin and forgiveness, I would have thought. But because you were a grown-up, still I would have answered you politely. The resurrection means Jesus rose from the grave on Easter morning. If you don't believe it happened, just like if you don't believe God loves you and forgives your sins, you can't go to heaven. So that was my sort of the basic conditions for my childhood and this depression that never lifted from one day or another. Once my depression finally did lift, I realized that I had no memory of ever having a day when I was not depressed. What did get through me, help me get through it all, and what offered me some relief was what I called, in those days as a child, I just called it beauty. It was religious, but I didn't connect it with the God that I'd heard about. Now, usually it would come to me in the form of light, one way or another. I would be outside and I would see a piece of broken glass or marbles or something like that, that colored glass that let the light through, and I would just take my breath away. But there were other things too that would capture me like that, and when it did, it would be a kind of transcendent experience. I didn't know the word transcendent, even though I was a bit precocious. But it was, it would be an experience that would fill me so full of joy that it would, for a moment, it would just lift the weight of some of this off me. And I didn't know to connect it with God. I knew it was holy, but it had nothing to do with the God that I'd experienced anyplace else. And I never, for some reason, gave it anthropomorphic characteristics, but I called it beauty. And that's still been important to me. And I have a huge marble collection even now. I love colored glass of any sort that lets the light through. So even in that point, God was coming to me in the form of grace, in light, but I didn't connect it with it. Now, when I was 11 and a half, my parents were divorced, and my depression got much worse. Part of it was because I believed that my father had left because of my own failures as a daughter. And that's a whole nother story. Children tend to think that when their parents are divorced. And I went through a long period as an adult when I said, well, that was not a reasonable thing to believe. But then when my father left his third wife when the oldest child was the same age I was, I realized that, well, there probably was something to it. But it wasn't so much particular to me as my father just couldn't deal with adolescence of any sort. At any rate, my mother was just devastated by this divorce, which I felt that I had caused. And I thought that I decided in myself, and I can pretty much remember making this decision when I was 12, that it was my job to do something about it. And that there were two things that I had to do. The first thing is, for those of you who were at the crucifixion talk yesterday afternoon, I had become convinced fairly early on by many things having to do with discussion of what women should be like and so forth, and what love was, that if you love somebody, you share in their unhappiness. And that means that if you love them, you are as unhappy as they are. That you're under obligation to be unhappy with them in the same way they're unhappy. So I decided that I was obligated, therefore, to share in my mother's unhappiness by being unhappy, that I had, because I'd caused this and because I loved her, no right to any happiness, even to aspire to this. Well, this was not a hard one to fulfill since I was already pretty depressed. But the other thing is that I decided that since it was my failures that had caused this, that what I had to do was I had to become perfect. I had to be all the things. Now I would have to be all the ways, fulfill the expectations she had. I had to be a girl who was like my mother's nieces on my mother's side. And I had to be, I had to fulfill all of my mother's one set of expectations and then this other set. And it was impossible. I could never fulfill them anyway. But I decided that's what I should have to do. And that one didn't work. And I thought of all that in terms of vindicating my mother. Now that word vindicating, that phrase was one that my mother actually used, but I took it on myself unsuccessfully. Anyway, I ended up leaving that situation when I was 18 and marrying a man whose expectations of me made the family expectations up until that point look negligible. It probably would have taken 1,500 wives or so to fulfill all his expectations. So this was not what we think of as a successful situation, and it didn't do anything for my depression, I can tell you that. I ended up in a Protestant seminary in the early 60s, in a Methodist seminary. And for a long time, that seemed to promise me that if I could abandon the kind of evangelical religious point of view that had gotten a grip on me as a child, if I could instead adopt some of the liberal Christianity that I met in seminary, and which I'd also met in other places in my high school years, Now, this would get me off some of the hook of my own guilt and feeling of responsibility for things that I couldn't seem to get a hold of. And I'd like to share a little of my outlook on that one. One of the most important things that attracted me to Protestant liberalism in my seminary years was that it was not the conservative Christianity of my childhood. The liberal Protestantism of the seminary in the early 60s had nothing but contempt for any form of Christianity that was focused on a personal relationship with God, on faith in Jesus' atoning blood shed for individual sins, or heaven or hell. Jesus was not interested in our individual relationships with God. The work of Jesus was to announce the inbreaking of the kingdom in this life as it had been proclaimed by the prophets. This was why Jesus had been crucified, because he preached God's radical demand for social justice. The trouble with that was that, in its own way, this form of Protestant liberalism, with its emphasis on the cross, made me feel more helpless than the conservative Christianity I was trying to escape. As I experienced it in those days, liberalism was a grim religion, and its public and private preaching relied almost entirely on the power of guilt to motivate its listeners. Just as much so, in fact, as the revival preachers of my childhood. Now, rather than being warned of the last judgment in the light of my metaphysical badness, I heard continual sermons on Amos. Why do you seek the day of the Lord? It is darkness and not light. I hate, I despise your feasts. God was in a rage over the sin of my participation and complicity in the web of racism upon which society was built, because racism was the one issue that was of interest in seminary in the early 60s. Certainly, I knew that what I heard was right. The racist society in which I was a part, by virtue of being white and middle class, really was built on the backs of the poor. My middle class comforts brought suffering to children, women, and men all over the country I had never even met. And the fact that I'd never meant to cause pain did not let me off the hook. But what was I to do about it? The primary answer in my seminary days was to take up the cross through social action. Now, social action in my seminary did not mean working in soup kitchens or performing small private acts of charity or kindness. Social action meant devoting yourself heroically to the radical politics of change, to participation in public demonstrations. Social action meant dropping your concern for the ordinary and small things of the everyday world to sacrifice your life to bring in the kingdom. Now, not everybody is willing to go all the way with social action. What every socially sensitive real Christian could do, however, was to accept that no one had a right to value the ordinary or to be happy in the face of the suffering one caused other people simply by living as part of the middle class. If the Christian did not have the guts to abandon middle-class life in an overt way, then he or she could still demonstrate solidarity with those who suffered by internally rejecting ordinary life to live in a perpetual state of self-flagellating guilt. This, for me, already struggling with depression, was a deadly message. I wanted to meet all the conflicting expectations and gain the approval of my family, my husband, and my friends. I wanted to be good in the eyes of God. Now I wanted the approval of my classmates on the one hand, and all those I hurt by my middle-class existence on the other. But by being a woman in seminary, I was already the object of hostility and scorn of many of my male classmates and their wives. There was only one other woman doing the basic degree at seminary when I was there, about 400 students. With my whole heart, I was against racism and the suffering it caused, but at the same time, not only did I not have the ability or the disposition to do much in politics, I was also a full-time married student in a marriage where the responsibility of shopping, cooking, cleaning, and laundry fell entirely on me. I was already in trouble at home for forgetting to buy toilet paper, failing to get meals on the table on time, and scorching the shirts while I was studying. Now I was being told that even doing these feminine things right was worse than contemptible. Sexism had not yet been discovered as a social justice issue in my seminary. I had no time, no money, and I couldn't drive. I couldn't be socially active in the only way that was pronounced acceptable. I felt I had no choice. Once more, I turned against myself to accept this extra burden of guilt, and my depression grew. So those were not my best years. not my happiest years. Now, when I went off to graduate school, I experienced the writings of the early church. You all have heard me talk about that enough already, probably, that you don't need to hear me say too much more about that, except that I encountered there, in those early Christian texts, a God that I had never encountered any place else that I can remember through the whole range of evangelical conservative Christianity or liberal Christianity. I encountered a God in those early texts that looked at human beings with complete compassion and love and liked them. Not liked them in spite of who they were, or loved them but couldn't stand them, but actually liked them. And, as I said, looked at human sin not as a horrible offense against God, but as a kind of sickness and wound to the human spirit that God wanted to heal. Now, my experience of that was earth-shaking at the time. At the same time, I knew from my first experience of that onward that if I really took that seriously and I let myself completely believe it, that I couldn't maintain anything else in my life as it was, that I would not be able to stay in my marriage, that I would not be able to do the things women are supposed to do and accept things, I mean, in that early, in the 60s, that women are supposed to accept, that I would be in a position where I just couldn't, I had my choice. I could have God in that vision of human freedom, or I could have life as I knew it. But if I chose God, I would have no society to go with it. There was a sort of incipient women's movement then, but I didn't know about it. So I had no support anywhere. And for me, these were not political issues, these were life and death issues. Now, political issues are always life and death issues, but we're talking about gut-wrenching issues here. It took me a long time. I did my dissertation on that early material, and I continued to read that stuff avidly. And finally, I left that marriage, and after having two children, you know, I'd been teaching at Notre Dame for 7 years at that point, and I was divorced, and later I remarried Richard. And I continued to teach that material, and I went to Candler School of Theology and began to teach there at that point. That was 20 years ago. Now, when I married Richard, I was still working from the assumption that I was still working out of the old assumptions. When I returned to the States from graduate school after 3 years, I soon felt worse than ever. Let me skip back for a minute. I'd come back to the advent of the women's movement in 1968, which was enormously helpful, but also to the myth of the superwoman, which was not. If you are already suffering from the fact that you can't meet anybody's expectations, having the myth of the superwoman held out to you is not helpful. Now I tried to be all things to all people in earnest. I tried to please my husband and be a good wife in spite of my vocation as a scholar. I wanted to make my mother proud of me in spite of my absent-minded housekeeping and desultory letter writing. I worked on my dissertation and I tried to be a good scholar. I gave birth to Anna Grace, and in spite of the rest of my life, I tried to be a good mother.
I began teaching at Notre Dame, and I tried to be a good teacher, and I finished my dissertation, and I gave birth to Benjamin, and continued to teach. In spite of how hard I'd worked and continued to work, whatever I did more than ever before, in the eyes of the people who mattered, it seemed to me it was still never enough. I was exhausted, and it's no wonder that my depression did not go away. Now, through all that, I think God continued to call me to a different life and release me from that, but I didn't know how to get to it. Though I did finally get to it, as I said, to the point where I was divorced from that first marriage and said, these things are not working. None of this is working for me. And later married Richard, who did not operate out of any of those categories that were the only ones that I had ever known, having to do with expectation and guilt and so forth. So that was that. I kind of went on from that point. The first years of my marriage to Richard were, as you can imagine, wonderful in most ways. It was wonderful to be married to Richard, but also you don't change your patterns of thinking that easily. I still was trapped in the depression. For one thing, I still hadn't had any ease from my depression, which had started since before I was in school. My mother says I was a happy baby. That's, you know, that's the testimony of my mother, but I have no memory of that. But I was very happy to be married to Richard in spite of continuing to be depressed. About 3 years after we were married, I started working through the material on the crucifixion that I talked about yesterday, and that was very helpful to me. That took about 3 years to do that, so that was like 6 years into the marriage before it happened. Now, one thing that I don't say in Memories of God that I don't mind saying in person, but my daughter would not like me writing about, does not like me to write about, is that Anna Grace, is whose birthday was yesterday, she was 29, is bipolar. And from the time she was little, 3 years old, she had major problems. But she wasn't diagnosed until she was 20. Now, one of the things that I had always thought since the time I was a small child was that I should not have children myself, that I had had such a miserable childhood that I didn't have a right to bring children into the world who could be even worse off than I was. But I went ahead and had Anna Grace when I was 28, and sure enough, she was a child even more unhappy than I was. And since I didn't know what the cause of it was, I kept thinking I should be able to help her, and I couldn't help her, you know. So it was very important to me to be a good mother, and I could not be a good mother. I mean, if you have a child who's mentally ill, she's going to be mentally ill. You know, you can make things a little easier, but you can't fix things. But I was very good at taking the blame for whatever it was, and people were very good at giving me the blame. I mean, all the time I was told by teachers and people like that, oh, you just have to love her more. Now, the secret message in you have to love her more is you don't love her enough. And when I would try to talk to doctors or anybody like that about what I thought was wrong, I would be told, well, you better be careful. It'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that, you know, I think, well, am I making her like this by just imagining? You know, so it was very difficult. Well, when she hit adolescence, things got really, really bad. And she was in all sorts of self-destructive behavior. When she was about 18, she moved out for a good long while. And she didn't, when she was on the high end of the bipolar stuff, she would also tend to get very angry and mistrustful of us. And she moved out and wouldn't tell us where she was for a good long time. She got involved with an abusive boyfriend who finally threatened her with a gun in public. And so we went to the police with that and finally got rid of him, but it took a long time. Well, by this time we're up to about Richard's and my 10th anniversary. And Richard is a person that loves to celebrate things. Now, ever since our 5th anniversary, Richard had been preparing for a party for our 10th anniversary. And he was just very excited about this whole idea of our 10th anniversary. And things were absolutely in the pits with Anna Grace. And I was feeling not just really depressed, but just hopeless. I just didn't know what was going to happen to her and what was going to happen to me. And I just couldn't bear the guilt. And kids of all ages, I mean, even babies are real good at sort of pushing their mother's buttons. And she had decided that she needed a car. And she hadn't been diagnosed, but I knew very well she did not belong driving a car. Mm-hmm. So she kept doing self-destructive stuff all the time, and then she would explain it when I would talk to her about it by saying, well, if you loved me enough to buy me a car, I wouldn't be doing this. So my prayers during this period were full of petitions asking God to help me love my daughter more, you know, just help me love my daughter more. And I just kept reading in the Gospels. All I could see in the Gospels was take up your cross. And you know, and I kept thinking, if I could not be so self-centered, I would be able to love her, and then the self-destructive behavior would go away on her part. If I could just take up my cross enough, you know. And it was the old pattern with my mother. If I could suffer enough with her and be unhappy enough with her, maybe that would somehow prove to her I loved her and rescue her. But of course this didn't work. So here we're coming up to the great event that Richard is looking forward to, and this in itself is making me feel incredibly guilty that I don't feel like celebrating to the respect to Richard did, because Richard was a wonderful person. And he deserved this, you know. So I sat down on the Friday before our anniversary and the party that we were going to have, and I will read you some of that from you that I have here. But finally, in a despair new even for me on this Friday, with our anniversary being on Sunday, I dragged myself into my study, and I sat down across from my desk in the tall red chair in which I've always had my prayers, and I cried out to God. I failed in everything you've given me to do. I've tried so hard to be a good mother. With my whole heart, I've wanted to love my children enough to keep them safe and happy. I've suffered with them and for them. And I begged you to help me love them well and in the right way. But the harder I try, the more I worry. There must be something essential about Christianity that I'm missing, something that I can't see. I give up. If there's something you want me to know about Christianity, you've got to find me yourself to tell me. I can try no longer. And I can look no longer. I give up. I absolutely give up. And I did give up, utterly. There in my familiar chair on that green April afternoon, the light of my life went out. My head fell on my chest, and my breathing slowed. My heart was torn in half, and out of those halves ran all the unmet and conflicting expectations, good intentions, and desires to please I had ever had. I didn't care if I was a good mother or a good teacher or a good daughter. I no longer suffered with those who suffered. I did not feel guilty. I did not accept my unhappiness as my due, nor did I reject my unhappiness. I did not fight against what was happening to me. Emptied at last of everything, I finally felt nothing. I simply sank like a dead body into darkness. And how long I sat there in that state, I have no idea. Perhaps it was a long time that passed. Perhaps it was simply a moment. I only know that all of a sudden and without any warning, I woke up. I heard my own voice repeating in my mind the words of the Eucharistic prayer for Easter. The joy of the resurrection renews the whole world. And every cell of my body heard these words, and for the first time, I knew that they were absolutely true, and that they were true for me. The joy of the resurrection renews the whole world, I repeated to myself in wonder. And while I spoke, my long broken heart was healed. The joy of the resurrection, I said to myself. And my heart filled up with a joy so fierce that it spilled out and ran through the whole of my body and flickered around me like a flame. In my red chair, I laughed out loud for pleasure, like a drunk or like a little child. And I thought that never in my whole life had I ever laughed before. Of course, there was something I'd missed about Christianity, and now all of a sudden I could see what it was. It was the resurrection. How could I have been a church historian and a person of prayer who loved God and still not know that the most fundamental Christian reality is not the suffering of the cross, but the life it brings? Of course, Jesus did not die to bring death to the world, but to establish the life God intends for us from the beginning. It was so obvious. The foundation of the universe for which God made us, to which God draws us, and in which God keeps us is not death, but joy. The joy of the resurrection renews the whole world, repeated itself within me, and now I felt or saw rather than heard God laugh with joy as God spoke without words within me. How could you ever have thought your goodness, your very right to existence, depends upon your pleasing even a person so significant to you as your own child? Do you not remember that I am the one, the only one who gives life, the only one who loves you without limit? I will never withhold it from you. And how could you ever have thought that you deserve to suffer? That you should pay for your existence with your suffering, that you could buy off other people's suffering with your own suffering. When you were a child and you made the anger of your parents your own and you turned it against yourself, did it bring you life? When you sank into your mother's grief and bitterness as though it was your own, did it rescue her or help you? When you took upon yourself your daughter's despair, did it lift it off her? There was a pause, and then I heard my own voice repeat again. The joy of the resurrection renews the whole world. And now I saw spread out before me wide fields, summer trees, bright mountains, and human beings without number, those I knew and those I did not, and all were upheld by God's own joyous self. Mysteriously, by a love so strong, so supple, and so subtle, I could hardly imagine it. By the light of that love, I could see that in my desire to be a good mother and my lifelong attempts to be found good by the people around me, and my efforts to escape the fact that whatever I did, I was always wrong, I had turned in on myself and away from the real world. To live not so much in a cave as in a teacup. Concerned about my own acceptability, how could I even have seen the people I cared for as separate from myself? How could I have responded to the actual needs of my flesh and blood daughter? How could I have let myself know that it is God who holds all living things in existence, not myself? That it is God who keeps each one of them, my daughter, my son, my mother, my students, in a secret covenant to which I have not only no access, but blessedly need no access. At last, I knew fully what I had already begun to learn in my experience of the crucifixion many years before. truly, Jesus had not died to show me I must earn my right to be loved, nor been crucified so that I could take it onto my own shoulders, so I could take on my own shoulders infinite responsibility for the pain of the world. Jesus had died for the new creation, for the joy of the resurrection of the whole world. For me that day, the promises of Isaiah had been fulfilled. On this mountain, the God of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, and God will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all people. God will wipe away the tears from all faces and the disgrace of God's people. God will take away from all the earth. And it will be said on that day, this is our God. This is God for whom we have waited. Let us be glad and rejoice in God's salvation. On my way to Jerusalem, I found that the bitter valley of my life had become a place of springs. I had sown in tears, I had reaped in joy, and my mouth was filled with laughter. With my eyes, I saw before me a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God like a bride adorned for her husband. A long time later, as I sat in my chair, the intensity of my joy and the drunken clarity of my thoughts subsided. After a while, I took up my vacuuming and I dusted. I cleaned the bathroom. Then I threw out some of the moldy stuff from the refrigerator. And like one miraculously snatched from death, I enjoyed all these everyday tasks with a single heart. Every 15 minutes or so for the rest of the weekend, those words repeated themselves to me, burning themselves into my very flesh. The joy of the resurrection renews the whole world. That Easter weekend, which was also the weekend of our anniversary, the God of beauty of my childhood, the God who had come to me in Hebrew, which I'd learned in seminary, and had appeared to me in the cross, lifted me from the grave and brought my 45-year depression to an end. Our anniversary party was wonderful. The very air quivered with spring. Richard's hair curled exuberantly. Some of the guests brought a cherry tree in bloom and a picnic basket and a cookbook. We played loud music and everyone stood close together and ate and drank and laughed. Of course, in the years that followed, all has not always been well. I still struggle, as I should, to push against the terrible injustices of the world, but I do it now from the energizing perspective of the promise of joy rather than the paralyzing perspective of guilt. Though I hardly worry about my housekeeping anymore, I do worry about my teaching. I still have periods where I forget to love my children by listening to what they themselves actually need and want, instead of my loving them by being a good mother. But so what? Even Jesus was resurrected with his wounds. So that was my experience with the resurrection. And that was a life-changing event for me. Not just in terms of my depression, but also in how I understand God and what it is that God wants for us and calls us to through the person of God incarnate in Jesus Christ. So I open this for comments, questions, discussion. Let me say one thing before anybody says anything. That was the end of my depression. I periodically have a little bit of trouble with it, most people do. And I came to the end of that depression through the process of my prayer. What I do not want to suggest, though, is that, if Roberta could do it, then anybody ought to do that. For myself, I think depression is such a terrible thing that any help you can get from it, if you can take medication and get some relief from it, then you can deal with some of these mental things that go into it, the kind of thinking that goes into depression. But do not hear this as a statement that you can pray your way through depression. Any help you can get, I'm in favor of. So I just wanted to say that before we get into conversation here.
When did you start writing?
I started writing around 1982. And it was hard for me because I had been trained to do one kind of scholarly writing, but it wasn't what I was called to do. But to do the kind of writing I do, that was another place where I violated everything, all the expectations of my teachers, and you know, that was a big area of the violation of expectations. First book that I wrote, to pray and to love, I mean, to love as God loves, this was after my dissertation, we won't count my dissertation, that was written as I wanted to write a book. It was so hard for me to overcome those inhibitions in myself. It took me 5 years to write it. It's just a little book. But then as I kept pushing against that voice in myself saying, no, Roberta, you can't, you shouldn't, you're being bad. Everyone will make fun of you and you will be despised and not get tenure. The more that I, you know, the more that I kept writing, the easier it got. And I keep pushing against these sort of sense of expectations.
So you feel that, and I think I've heard this before, how writing the memoirs, or at least recalling memories through computer, does help with your depression somewhat? At least to get into the facts and
well, I'd be really careful about saying that. I don't think it's just recalling memories for the sake of memories. It's look at examining them in the context of prayer, in which you put those memories over against the things you've been taught, and you think, how have my religious principles helped me understand who I am? Have these helped me or hurt me? Mm-hmm. Have I misunderstood what this doctrine is really about? I mean, it was important for me to realize I just didn't have the foggiest idea what the resurrection was about. Nor, you know, earlier I just sort of thought, what's this crucifixion stuff about? You know, so it's a process that is at the same time intensely brain intensive. You have to really think, but you also have to let yourself feel all the stuff you don't want to feel. You have to go back and relive those events in your memories in the presence of God. Now, when I wrote this book, The Memories of God, I got a lot of letters later from people saying, how do you do that kind of work? And as a result, I wrote another book, which is In Ordinary Time, and the subtitle is Healing the Wounds of the Heart. In the first two chapters, I try to talk about how you do that kind of work, and then there are four narrative chapters after that. But this is, but just, it's not just going over memories for the sake of going over memories. Lots of times you just go over your memories, all you're doing is reinforcing those old patterns. Mm-hmm. You know, what you need to do is to be given the grace to see all that in a new way. You know, that's really...
Expand.
Yeah. Yes.
Reportedly, I'm thinking about my confirmation students.
Uh-huh.
I so want for them to know the power of the resurrection experientially. Do you have any guidance about either modeling an integrated story or sharing autobiographical details, like from my own life, in the hopes that they will hear that, or
well,
how do you approach that for younger students? Or for that matter, with college students?
I think that we need to tell stories, whether they are of our own experience or of others' experience, or help people learn to read novels. We need to learn to make the connection between our stories and other stories, to claim our own stories. I mean, one of the things that happens to kids and college students too is they say, "Well, nothing important has happened to me," you know. You know, there's nothing significant about my life, but the fact is that all human lives are significant. And so it's a lot of learning to claim the power of the resurrection is learning to claim the significance of our lives to God. And it's not enough to say in the abstract, God values each one of us. It has to do with learning to value our stories and then helping other people learn to value their individual stories. Yes?
I'm more, Roberta, out of me as a teacher than my interest in theology. But the kind of cliche growth pattern that we hear about these days for girls is that they may achieve until they're about 11 and then like this, like in the driving off field. It sounds a little like you did the opposite. When did you begin?
I was always a slow learner. I blossomed in my 40s. I don't think I ever had that period of confidence that girls are supposed to go through and enthusiasm. I was too much under the influence of, you know, being quiet and being good and not disturbing anybody. And I lived in an apartment, and you know, a small apartment, and it wasn't conducive to very much that is natural.
What got you thinking you could ever be a scholar?
Yeah. Oh, that's a really long story, and I don't think I ever did think I could be a scholar. I know when I started graduate school, one of the facts of my life, I still struggle with this a little bit, is when I was a child, I never believed I was going to grow up. I mean, I had it in my head that I would not grow up past, you know, I might get to be 18, but I wouldn't grow up. I couldn't imagine how I could be grown up. It just didn't seem plausible, you know, somehow. So nothing I ever did had any long-term sort of goals connected with it. And then when I went to college and I went to graduate school, I never believed that I would ever be a scholar or a teacher. I wanted to learn those things for the present. Now, part of me, there was a little voice inside me that always said, if you're ever going to get out of here, this is what you're going to have to do. Mm-hmm. I always had that in the back of my mind, that this would be my way out. But I never really believed I would be able to do it. I got my first teaching job as a fluke. I was in South Bend, Indiana with my first husband who was teaching at Indiana University at South Bend. And I met somebody at a party who had a DPhil. Oxford does everything backwards, so the DPhil is PhD spelled that backwards, you know. So I met somebody else at a party. He had a DPhil from Oxford in Semitic Studies, which is what my first degree was in there. And so he knew what I'd done in the way of my work, and he knew who I was. And he hired me, you know, without ever having an interview or anything like that. So that was the way I started teaching at Notre Dame. And then when I started teaching at Candler, I didn't ever want to teach at Candler. I didn't want to teach in a seminary. I did not regard myself as a religious person. And they told me 20 years ago, you know, they taught me into coming to the interview. And I said, I don't want to come to the interview. I don't want the job. And they called me at the beginning of February of that year. And it was my first husband had moved out shortly before that. And the weather was just terrible, and the public schools had been closed for 2 weeks, and Anna Grace and Benjamin and I had been standing in the kitchen washing dishes the night after they called, and the kitchen ceiling had fallen in on us because the snow on the roof had been melting and going down, coming up under the shingles and rotting out plaster. So I said, I don't want the job, but I'll definitely come for the interview. I said, if you want to take the chance, I'm telling you in advance that I don't want it, but I'll come. You know, I'd do anything to get out of here. I said, you know, 2 days out of South Bend was my idea of heaven. So I did everything obnoxious I could think of when I went down for my job interview. Because they told me before that I went that they wanted me as a role model for their women students. And, you know, I thought the last thing on earth that I had to do is a role model for a bunch of women ministers. You know, I can't do, you know, if they knew half of the, any of the, a small portion of the stuff about who I really am. You know, they know what kind of mistake they're making. So I did everything I could to blow it, most of which is not even repeatable. But they offered me the job. Anyway, in spite of this. And I'd been reading all this early church stuff. See, when I was at Notre Dame, I taught mostly Hebrew and Syriac and Aramaic. I was a Semiticist. That was what my first training was. So they wanted me to teach church history and stuff like that. And I had a very peculiar education, which we don't have time to go into now, thank God. But at any rate, I didn't feel prepared to be a role model for anybody. But I had been reading this patristic literature and working on this early monastic material for myself privately all this time, and learning my Christianity from these people, but I had no way to talk about it because, again, there was no sort of slot to do it in legitimately. You know. So I got ready to, I was thinking about, was I going to take this job or not? And I did not want the job. I mean, I absolutely did not want the job. And the early church people I work on, the Abbas and the Amos, kept talking to me, as they tend to do, you know, and they kept saying things like, now, Roberta, either you mean what you say, that we're really, the stuff we have is life-transforming, or we're just a hobby. Now, you take your pick. If you're really serious, you're going to have to take the job. Otherwise, you can just back off from all that, and we'll just say, this is an interesting hobby. And what you're really interested in is making it in the academy, according to what looks good to your Oxford teachers and so forth. And I kept saying, shut up, I don't want to hear that, just don't tell me that, and they kept saying it. So I took the job. So in my work then just had to take a right angle turn, you know, because I wasn't even hired to teach the same stuff I was teaching at Notre Dame. So anyway, that's the story of my academic jobs. And then I did have to learn a new way of writing, and then I had to get brave enough to do it. But they kept encouraging me and telling me that the only way you get over fear is by confronting head on the things that you're afraid of. And of course, they're right. It's 7:21, so it's time to quit. Anybody want to hang around another 5 minutes? We can do that. So I've enjoyed being with you all this week, and last week also. There aren't very many of you here who were also here last week, but I've enjoyed all of you. We're leaving tomorrow. So I will go back to Canberra, where I've been called to teach. And I'll polish up all my role model skills to get ready for the beginning of school, which will be in 3 weeks.
Where is Candler?
Candler is the Methodist seminary at Emory University in Atlanta.
Oh.
It's the biggest Methodist seminary.